Shrink Wrap Radio number 462, Carl Jung and Eric Neumann, with Jungian analyst Dr. Nancy Ferlotti.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today is Jungian analyst Dr. Nancy Swift Ferlotti, and we'll be discussing the correspondence between C.G. Jung and Eric Neumann, as well as the conference Dr. Ferlotti attended in Israel last year devoted to this topic. For more information about Nancy Ferlotti, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Dr. Nancy Ferlotti, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, David. It's very nice to be back.
Well, it's nice to have you back, and also it's nice to be able to say Dr. Nancy Ferlotti, because last time I couldn't say that.
That's correct. You couldn't, and I had to be very careful about that, even though I was right on the brink of actually receiving my PhD.
Well, congratulations on that important step. I know sometimes people get right up to the edge, and then they get so busy doing things that it takes a long time for them to finish up. Is that what happened to you?
Well, no, actually, I was quite anxious to finish my dissertation. I was so enthralled with it and quite passionate about it that energy kept me going.
Oh, well, good for you. Now, for our listeners, I just want them to know that you and I have spoken here twice before. The first time was Shrink Wrap Radio number 242, The Red Book of C.G. Jung, and which we went all through that because the Red Book had sort of just become public not long before that. And then later we spoke about the book that you co-edited on Shrink Wrap Radio number 366, The Dream and Its Amplification. And so now, going to have you here today. It's great to have you back again. And today we're going to be speaking about the correspondence between Carl Jung and Eric Neumann.
Yes.
And I understand that you went to a conference in Israel about this very topic this past year. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, I did. The conference was held at a beautiful kibbutz just north of Tel Aviv called Kibbutz Shefaim, and it took place in April. And it was quite an event. It celebrated the publication of the Jung-Neumann correspondence, which is actually called Analytical Psychology in Exile.
Uh-huh.
And it was organized, and the person who really took charge and was able to really pull the whole thing together was Dr. Arel Shalit, with whom I did write the Dream Amplification book.
And that's right. I remember that.
It was a very well-attended international conference. We had about people from about 25 different countries.
Wow.
And we brought together both the Jung's grandsons and a great-grandson, and Eric Neumann's two children, Micha and Raleigh Neumann.
Wow. Well, it sounds like quite an event. Now, I suspect that many listeners out there are about as unfamiliar with Neumann as I was and have been, although it was a name I would encounter in my reading. but I really didn't know who he was. I've since gone to Wikipedia, but so I found out some things. But why don't you take us through what you know of Neumann, his background, and why do so many people care, you know, this in 2014?
Well, they care because he was a brilliant thinker, very, very interesting mind. And along with that, he had a deep connection to his feeling sense, which is sometimes not so completely evident in Jungian writing, especially early on like that. This was a man who grew up in Berlin, which was educated in Berlin, Germany, and left Germany in 1933 to move to what was then called Palestine, Israel. He saw what was transpiring in Germany at that time, and he was in medical school there, but was not allowed to do his internship because of the Nazi race laws that had been implemented in Germany at that time. And shortly before that, he had attended a lecture in Germany given by Jung and was really fascinated with analytical psychology, Jung's approach. And so on his way to Israel, he stopped in Zurich. He was able to get an appointment with Jung and began working in analysis with Jung. And this was while he was leaving his home country. He was moving his family, his wife, Julia, and his son, Micha Neumann. They came to Zurich for a little while with husband, father, Eric Neumann, and then he sent them along to Israel. And Eric Neumann remained in Zurich working with Jung for about 6 months, before he then went on to Palestine himself. And it's right away, it's very interesting, even before leaving Switzerland, Eric Neumann writes Jung a letter. I guess he feels that he would be better putting it in writing as opposed to stating his thoughts directly to Jung. But in any event, we have this wonderful beginning correspondence between Eric Neumann and Jung, where this young man, and in 1933, just to put these two figures in perspective, Jung was 58 years old, and Neumann was 28 years old.
Okay, so, about 30 years separating them.
Yeah, a 30-year age difference.
Mm-hmm.
And Jung was very established in his career. He was a renowned analytical psychologist. He was doing an awful lot of teaching at that time. And, of course, Neumann was just beginning. He was in a process of a big transition in his life and just beginning his career. So there was quite a large disparity between them. But that didn't hold Eric Neumann back when he had a reaction to things people either said or wrote. And he was given an article called The State of Psychotherapy Today that Jung wrote at that time. And because of that, he had a very strong reaction to a number of things that were mentioned in that article, and I read
on Wikipedia or someplace that there were times of tension between them because of Jung's seemingly pro-Nazi stance. Is that what you're getting to now?
That's what I'm getting to, and it wasn't ever a pro-Nazi stance. That's kind of a mistaken myth that has been created and kind of spread around. And the correspondence itself is a good way to actually see the conversations between Jung, who is a Christian, and Eric Neumann, who's a Jew, talking about these issues of national socialism and why Neumann actually calls Jung to task on a number of his statements and a number of his mostly sweeping generalities and some of his actions during this period of time around 1933, 1934, when Jung got involved with an international organization of psychologists where he was actually trying to help the German Jungians, the German psychologists, to maintain the German Jewish psychologists to maintain a connection to a more international organization. And it's a whole sequence of events that I won't go into right now, but Jung did have some blind spots, and he said some things that were quite offensive to Neumann. For example, Neumann really takes him to task on his sweeping statements having to do with Jews, all Jews being a certain way, that all Jews are rootless, for example, or they're nomadic, and they will never have a culture of their own. They always depend on a host culture. And Neumann says, you don't really know Jews. You are looking at the German Jews who've basically given up their Judaism. They're the assimilated Jew, much like Freud and much like Adler. And that is, you can't extrapolate and say that is who all Jews are, because that is not the case. And he goes on and he says, you need to do some studying on Judaism. You've done all this incredible work on studying comparative mythologies and comparative religions, for example, Hinduism and Buddhism and all sorts of more archaic religions and the Egyptian mythologies and all the rest, but you obviously don't have much of an understanding of what Judaism is all about and how constantly changing it is and how it reinvents itself. And he compares those statements that he's making to some that Jung made about the new spark that Jung was seeing emerging out of the Germanic Aryan psyche at that time in history. And I have a feeling that all of this stems from Jung's reaction to Freud and his criticism towards Freud for devaluing Jung's Germanic psyche. And so in this article, he's taking Freud and Adler to task by basically saying, you can't reduce everything to nothing but. You can't reduce human beings to a technique. You have to bring yourself as an analyst, a person who's done a lot of work on his or herself, and you have to sit in the room with your patient and see that individual as unique and allow that person's psyche to enter the room in whatever unique and unusual way it will.
That's Jung saying that, right?
That's Jung saying that. And so,
I'm sorry, was that Jung or Neumann saying that?
That was Jung saying that.
Okay.
In contrast to Freud. So in this article that seems to be a real pivotal point between Jung and Neumann, Jung begins criticizing Freud and then jumps into kind of these generalities about Jews, which is what Neumann takes him to task on, because he is quite surprised that Jung, with all of his theory and his consciousness and his greatness, would make such kind of overarching generalized statements.
Mm-hmm. And good for him.
Yeah,
good for him. That's courageous. Good for him.
At 28 years old, he's really able to do this. Of course, later on, he describes himself as being like a lion, and I guess both of them are kind of like lions, and he acknowledges that he has an anger that will erupt out and force him to take these strong stands, even when he's standing up against his analyst, his mentor, and this very distinguished 58-year-old teacher. So,
was this dynamic discussed much at the conference that you attended?
It was discussed a bit, yes. At the conference, of course, it was based on the publication of this book and this correspondence. But all the lecturers who were, they were all invited. It wasn't a conference where it was open to people submitting papers. They were all selected, and they gave a talk on a subject of their choice. So we had lecturers who were talking specifically about the correspondence, and then many who were talking about certain aspects of it. For example, Ricardo Bernardini is the archivist at Aranos, which is where Neumann spent many weeks giving lectures and participating in the wonderful roundtable discussions there with all sorts of intellectuals and people not only interested in Jungian psychology but biology and physics and Kabbalah, and I mean it was really an incredible intellectual gathering. So he came from the point of view of discussing Neumann's relationship to Aranos, and Jung actually participated in Aranos from 1933 to 1951. He would go most years and give a lecture. Neumann started going in 1948 and continued right through until 1960, shortly before he died. And so it was a way of honing one's thinking and delivering papers and discussing those papers and just quite an incredible roundtable. So that was a very important part of Eric Neumann's life, because he found a home there. And out of that experience, he published the Great Mother. I don't know if you've read his book on the Great Mother, which is...
I have not, but I understand it's a seminal work.
It truly is. It truly is. And, of course, many other books and articles came out of his work at Aranos. So that was fascinating to see that part of Neumann's life, especially in contrast to how he was rejected by the Zurich analysts, and rejected, I think, mostly because of something like a sibling rivalry, that those analysts felt that Neumann was preempting Jung, was perhaps a little too brilliant, was a very good writer, a very expansive writer. Of course, he wrote his second book, actually, The Origins and History of Consciousness. You may have read that one.
You're embarrassing me by how much I have not read.
Well, you see, that's exactly why the publication of this correspondence and the conference itself is so significant, because Eric Neumann is an extremely significant was an extremely significant Jungian analyst, and one of Jung's closest friends. Actually, Jung said later on in his life that he had two close friends. There were two men with whom he could share his personal thoughts and life with. And one was Eric Neumann, and he lived in Tel Aviv, and the other was Father Victor White, and he lived in England, and then in the United States.
So, in a way, I got the sense that just as Jung for a while had been Freud's prince, that Neumann kind of became Jung's prince.
Yes, exactly, and that has been that idea has been thrown around that Jung was not able to take over for Freud, and yet he was challenged again by Neumann, who was put in the same position that he was put in with Freud.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how it all comes around.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It comes around.
It certainly does come around. And their relationship, they were very, very close. But they didn't mince words with each other. They were completely honest. And that's what's so incredibly fresh and interesting about the letters between them, is that there was a tremendous amount of affection, but each of them called the other on certain things. They were very direct and very honest with each other, too.
Well, I gather there were something like 100 letters back and forth. Is that about right?
Yes, there were. There were more letters from Eric Neumann, of course, but there were times when Eric Neumann would write a series of letters before getting a response from Jung, and then Jung would apologize because he was so incredibly busy during that period of time. And also during the time around 1944, when he had his first heart attack, and then he had a second heart attack in 1946. So Neumann, being in Israel, was not really able to keep up completely and wasn't quite aware, for example, of how sick Jung was. So he would continue to write letters, and Jung would get back to him when he was able to. And also, as they both grew older, Jung grew, being 30 years older, he was quite older, and didn't quite have the energy that Eric Neumann had.
Right. You know, one of the things that strikes me is I wonder if that kind of relationship could even happen today with the internet and email and, you know, the way that I think communications are briefer and less substantial.
Well, I agree, and I've actually been concerned about this myself. Are we going to have correspondences in the future? I'm not so sure people are going to be so interested in short little email blurbs back and forth between certain people.
Yes.
Are we losing our are we losing something important? Now, maybe we're gaining something important too, on the other hand, but are we losing a slower, more thoughtful means of communicating with each other by giving up writing letters? Mm-hmm. You know, from what I understand, there's a big movement now in the schools to no longer teach students script writing.
Yeah, cursive, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those future children are not going to even be able to read the the founding documents of our own country.
Hmm. Wow. Well, I got us off on a little bit of a tangent here.
Yeah.
What are the main themes that run through the correspondence?
Well, there are about three main themes that run through the correspondence between the two. Of course, right off the bat, the main theme has to do with the state of Germany, National Socialism, anti-Semitism, and what's going on around that, Jung's reaction to that. One more thing that I wanted to say is that I think part of Jung's reaction is that he's so fascinated with the movement of the archetypes out of the German psyche that he somehow loses sight of the shadow implications of this archetypal movement, the movement of National Socialism and Nazism. Of course, Neumann is right there in the center of it, and he sees it very clearly.
Now, how does that articulate with Jung's dream of blood washing over the Alps and so on? That seemed to presage the coming Second World War and how awful that was going to be.
Well, those visions that he had actually preceded World War I.
Oh, okay, World War I.
Yeah, they preceded World War I, and that they were instrumental in Jung's own descent into his unconscious, which, of course, he wrote about in the Red Book. At first, he thought, when he had those visions, that he was falling into a psychosis because he couldn't believe how horrible those visions were until World War I broke out. And then he realized that he was picking up collective elements.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's interesting. He picked them up so clearly before World War I, but here we are then at World War II. And I think it had to do with his own personal relationship with Freud, and also I think it had to do with his fascination around what was emerging out of the Germanic psyche, of course, he being Germanic himself. Freud devalued Jung's Germanic psyche. And so it was almost a reaction. Again, well, you see, you can't treat us as infantile with our Germanic psyche. There is something youthful and creative that can also emerge out of the Germanic psyche. And so I think there was an element of standing back, watching with great curiosity, and not actually knowing how this whole thing was going to play out. And he did that. You see that through the writings, that he wants to stand back and he wants to look at both sides. He doesn't want to all of a sudden jump and say, well, this is how it's going to be. He sees the good and the bad. He sees the light and the dark. That's really what his psychology is all about, though paying attention to those opposites and not projecting the negative onto people, but holding one's opinion until life itself starts playing things out. And I think he did that, and I think people criticized him for not taking a stronger stance earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Although my sense is, in reading through all this material, he may have had a bit of a blind spot, but he understood what was going on pretty quickly.
Yes.
Now, you asked about the themes. Well, that definitely was a very important theme and an early theme in the correspondence. And then Neumann moves into, of course, his own feelings around evil. because he's watching what's going on in Germany. And it's important to remember that he's also in Palestine at the very beginning of his country, Israel, as it's fighting for its own independence. And so it's quite brutal over there. And Israel is at war. And at one point, he says his neighbor's house, this house right next door to his house, was bombed, and 18 people were killed.
Wow.
18 people were wounded, and one was killed. I think that's what it was. And so he's right in the thick of it there in Israel at that point in history, and he's also watching as 6 million Jews are being killed in Europe. So during the war, their communications stopped. And Neumann, out of that, wrote a book called The Depth Psychology and the New Ethic, which had to do with his own feelings around what was going on in Europe and with Nazi Germany and the issue of evil. And basically what he says is that we have to move from the old traditional ethic, which regards good and evil as opposites, that we have to stand on the side of good and try to be as good as possible and fight against evil. In other words, split them, which then causes projection of one's shadow onto other people. It causes scapegoating. It's basically the old Yahweh complex, where you're dealing with good and evil. And he moves to a new ethic, which is a new psychology, which actually is very much in line with Jung's thinking and analytical psychology, that the individual now has to carry him or herself those opposites and struggle with those opposites, the opposites of good and evil, that both reside in the individual, and it's the individual's responsibility to help that become conscious and help transform that unconsciousness into consciousness. And through that process, the God image itself is transformed. And of course, this is something that interests Jung tremendously. And he later wrote his book on the answer to Job, which addresses this very issue. And so the conversations that they have around Neumann's book, The New Ethic, are very, very interesting. And I think in the long run, extremely helpful to Jung in his thinking around his own idea, a similar idea of how the individual is the place where consciousness is actually transformed, where evil can be transformed. And they get into this. This is a theme that starts right after the war, when they begin their correspondence again. And then it's picked up towards the very end of their life, when they begin talking not only about evil again, but they talk about consciousness and whether God is conscious or whether there's a kernel of consciousness in humans. And where does consciousness actually become transformed? And they go back and forth, and they have a very interesting, very intellectual discussion that's almost a little bit difficult to follow because it's so intellectual, but it's absolutely fascinating to hear their musings about God and about God's relationship to humans, whether we were made in God's likeness or not, whether the kernel of potential consciousness resides in God or in us? Is God conscious or is God unconscious? All these very interesting questions. But in the middle area, there's another discussion that they have. Neumann gets very interested in Jewish consciousness. After he writes The Origins and History of Consciousness, he becomes increasingly interested in the roots of Jewish consciousness. And he starts exploring this issue by looking at Jacob and Esau, the story of Jacob and Esau, and writes a lot about that. And then from there he moves into writing an actual book, a 3 or 4 part book on the roots of Jewish consciousness that have to do with including the Hasidic movement, which he feels is a real kind of reformation of the older Messianic Judaism. And luckily for us, these two books will be published. And the Jacob and Esau book is actually edited by Dr. Arel Shalit, and that is going to be published by Chiron Publications, and it'll be out in, I believe, the end of 2015 or the beginning of 2016. And then The Roots of Jewish Consciousness will be edited by Ann Lammers, who edited the Jung White correspondence and the Jung Kirsch correspondence, and that will be out hopefully in about 2019. So we're going to have these two incredible publications that help fill in some of the some of Neumann's thinking during this period. Now, also, I should mention there's another book coming out which basically will be comprised of the lectures at the Jung Neumann Correspondence Conference in Tel Aviv. And this book will be out in the fall, and it's called Turbulent Times, Creative Minds, Erich Neumann and C.G. Jung in Relationship. And so for everybody who was not able to attend the conference, this will be a wonderful way of participating.
Uh-huh. Well, let's get a bit more into his work in feminine development, which according to Wikipedia, he's best known for. And you mentioned his book, The Great Mother. Do those, and he also works in mythology and looks at mythology throughout history, which I guess the whole Jewish consciousness thing that you're talking about probably is part of what's being referred to there. Do these topics related to feminine development occur at all in the correspondence?
Oh, absolutely, they do. They do. Neumann talks a lot about his needing to connect to the earth. And when Jung, for example, refers to Jewish rootlessness, Neumann basically says that it's that the shift, what is so important about Zionism and moving to Israel and rerouting in actual ground is something that is very important for Jewish consciousness. And he experiences this whole process by moving to Israel and experiencing for the first time being so grounded on his own soil. And through that, he has numerous dreams and visions that he talks about in the correspondence, having to do with the development of his anima, which of course is the Jungian term for the inner feminine. And you see through those dreams how his own inner feminine changes and transforms, and how he becomes so much more connected to her and to that, to his own feminine. He describes her as the dark native feminine. She emerges in a dream as a dark native feminine. And we were able to see watercolor paintings that he had done throughout his lifetime after starting analysis, is beautiful watercolors of his dream images and his visions. And so many of them had female figures in them of different kinds. And I was really struck by that, because by contrast, in Jung's Red Book, he has two paintings of two female figures. One is Salome, and the other is a female figure towards the end of the book who is standing on a up above a group of people, and she has a veil on and with gold falling onto her head. I mean, it's a beautiful image, but it's clearly a kind of a more spiritualized image of the feminine, whereas Neumann's are very raw and very real, very grounded. He talks a lot about the need for connection to the Shekinah. Of course, that has to do with the Kabbalah. And he talked to Jung a lot about the importance of course, Jung picking up and studying Judaism. It's not mentioned in the correspondence, but Jung actually did study the Kabbalah, and he got referrals for books and references from a Jewish colleague, Rivka Kluger, and he had a very significant dream around the time of his heart attack that reflected his deep connection to the Kabbalah and to the mystical marriage, which ultimately is what Mysterium Conjunctionis is all about, having to do with connecting to and bringing the Shekinah back, which is the feminine in the Kabbalah.
How do you spell that word, Shekinah?
Shekinah. Being a not a very good speller, I'm going to look here.
I just asked because it was a new word to me. And
No, it's really, I want to make sure that I have it correctly. Let's see if I can find this quickly. If it's in this book. It is Shekinah.
Oh, okay.
And so through the paintings and through his descriptions of the dreams and what he says, he talks about the development of his anima. And you see how many different manifestations of it he experienced through his own visions and his dreams. Now, the fact that in the Red Book we only see two images of the feminine, although there are of course many more in his dialogues and in his vision, his active imaginations and his dreams and visions, but and clearly his soul taking the snake form, and that is also the case with Neumann, that the feminine soul takes the snake form, which is quite common. It has to be remembered that Jung was of a different time. He was of a different generation. And so his expression would be different than Neumann's, 30 years younger. But it is, but one of the things that first attracted me to Erich Neumann's work, to tell you the truth, was the sense that this was a Jungian who had a tremendous connection to the feminine and to feeling. And when you read his writings, you see that right away, that something is very accessible. Something is present on a deep feeling level. And I really appreciated that. I mean, a lot of the Jungian stuff can be so heady and archetypal and wonderful. And
yes.
I love that as an intuitive thinking type, but also as a woman, my feeling side loves that that deep understanding of the feminine, which he definitely has. And he, in his book The Great Mother, you really see how he differentiates the Great Mother. He differentiates the feminine. And it is very, very helpful. One of the most important pieces that I got out of that was the way he describes the positive, you know, he calls it the negative transformative mother. And that's the mother, for example, and we're talking about the mother, we're not specifically talking about our mothers, we're talking about an archetypal energy, which can be in our mothers, but it can be in the feminine, it can be in the masculine. It's an archetypal energy. That is when the mothering goes overboard and it's too much mothering, and it actually turns into its opposite, which turns it into a destructive form. So it becomes destructive rather than positive. And you usually think that the nurturing mother would be supportive and helpful and wonderful. Well, if you take that too far, it actually flips into that opposite and becomes quite negative. And that was a real eye-opener for me in how he described that and made that so clear. I see that so frequently in my work with patients. And patients who are struggling so hard to separate from what they perceive as their good mothers, when actually that energy is very destructive, and they really do need to separate from that and differentiate from that, from what's good from the mother and really what isn't.
Yeah, that's something. Interestingly, that's been burlesqued in Jewish humor, right? The mother who's, who's kind of ends up being a smothering mother in terms of all of her caring for her son.
Yes, exactly. It certainly has. And maybe that's why he had a better sensibility of that. But the way he describes it is very, very helpful. He also wrote a book on amor and psyche, which on that story, and I don't know if you're familiar with that myth, the myth of amor and psyche. It's a beautiful myth of the transformation of the feminine.
Take us through the highlights of it. I know I've read it, but my brain is like a sieve for that.
Well, Psyche is the feminine. She's a young girl in this myth, and she falls in love with Amor, or Eros. Eros, the god of love and relationship. And she, of course, Eros is the son of Aphrodite, although that's in one way they say he's the son of Aphrodite, and another they say that Eros is one of the primary gods, most likely larger and before Aphrodite. But anyways, in this story, he's the son of Aphrodite. He falls in love with Psyche, and one of the rules of their relationship, and Psyche is mortal, one of the rules of their relationship is that she can never see him. So he only visits her at night, and then he sleeps with her, but she can never see him. And as the story goes on, the myth goes on, her psyche sisters start whispering awful things about Eros, about Amor, and who he could be and what he could actually look like. And so they get her to agree to light a lantern one night when they're together and he's asleep, which she does. She lights a lantern and she actually sees him, and he wakes up. The sisters, of course, were telling her, oh, he's really a monster, he's really an ugly old thing, and or a snake, or something awful, and here you are and having a relationship with this very strange creature. You have to take a look and see what he looks like. So she does that, and of course Eros wakes up, and at that point he disappears. And he says that this is the end of the relationship. He can never have anything more to do with her. And, of course, she is devastated. And then Aphrodite, the mother, this is the so-called mother-in-law archetype here, comes in and sends Psyche on a journey to accomplish certain very difficult tasks. I mean, this is kind of like what Hercules had to do, taking on his difficult tasks. Anyways, she was tested and had to find her way through these extremely difficult tasks, and ultimately she ended up succeeding with the help of certain animals, with help along the way, which is what always happens in one's psychic development, that when one feels most in despair, for example, when she's having to do an extremely difficult task like cleaning out a stable. I can't remember what her specific tasks were at this point, but just horrendous tasks. She would be in despair, and she would feel that she couldn't do it. She'd never be able to complete this by morning, and that she was a horrible failure. I mean, this is a depression that so many people find themselves in, that all of a sudden out come little mice, or out come other little animals that, or little helpful figures that will come in and do the task for her, so that she would be able to survive and move on to the next task. Well, this is kind of a template for individuation and what we all go through in our lives, and certainly when we're in analysis and we're focused on our own inner journey. And so as it ends, she successfully completes all those tasks, and she is accepted by Aphrodite, and she's turned into an immortal, and she's able to be reunited with her true love, Eros. And so Eric Neumann wrote a book about that and describes it from a psychological point of view. And it's really very beautiful. It really is. Of course, he takes up Psyche's position, the feminine, and understands it so well that I really appreciated that too. That also has been taken up by a number of other analysts. Later, Louise von Franz wrote on Psyche and Eros also. So it's a beautiful story.
Well, thanks for taking us through it again. Now, he's also, according to Wikipedia, my big source here, he's also known for the concept of centroversion. That is, we know about Jung's introversion and extroversion. He adds a kind of middle concept. Can you talk about that at all?
Yes, I can briefly talk about centroversion. It's not such an easy concept, but from What I understand of that concept is that it has to do with the movement from being kind of centralized in one's ego to having, establishing a relationship with the greater self. And so it's a movement out of believing that life revolves around one's own choices, kind of the ego, and it's stepping into a state of mind where one believes that there's actually something greater. There's a larger force that emanates from the unconscious that influences our actions almost more so than the ego. And it's interesting because neuroscience is actually showing that to be the case. It's really supporting that whole concept.
How so? I'm not sure I get that.
We make decisions not based on our rational mind, our function, but we make most of our decisions based on our more primitive mind, our emotional brain.
Okay, yeah, now I get it.
Where we're not completely conscious of the decisions that we make. And that is what I think Neumann, specifically with this concept, is referring to, that shift and that connection. It's kind of a growth. He describes the phases of development from early childhood into adulthood. And he also wrote a beautiful book on the child, too. He did a lot of work with children, child development, which was absolutely needed after World War II with everybody returning to Israel, especially the children. But it's a very interesting concept. And of course, Jung's whole idea that we are like, our consciousness is like an iceberg where the tip of it that we can see is only a fraction of what the iceberg actually is. The base of the iceberg would represent the unconscious,
right,
which is the part that is the primary motivator of our behaviors and our viewpoints and our attitudes. And so the reason he developed the theory he did and was a big proponent in self-exploration was to try to increase the tip of the iceberg and bring as much as we possibly could into consciousness so that our actions and behaviors would have a chance of being even a little somewhat conscious, where left to their own devices, they wouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nancy, as we begin to wind down here, I'm wondering if there are ways in which Neumann has influenced Jungian thought broadly. I'm wondering if there are things that those of us who think we know something about Jung in a general way, if there are sort of invisible contributions by Neumann that he helped steer the ship, if you will, maybe in some ways that we haven't fully credited him for.
Well, I would agree with that completely, David. I'm reminded of one very specific example in the correspondence where Jung and Neumann are talking about the new ethic, and Neumann asks Jung to write a foreword to his English edition, and before doing so, Jung wants Neumann to think about certain points that he raises around the book, one of those having to do with Neumann's use of the word castration complex. Jung wants him to instead talk about the archetype of sacrifice. But anyways, they get into these discussions around it. But Neumann's always very strong when he comes back. He reads Jung's suggestions, he takes them to heart, and if he doesn't agree with them, he comes back and he says, I don't agree with this, and I'll explain why. And through these discussions, at one point, Jung actually said, you know, my thinking has been changed by what you have described. And as a result of that, I have radically altered some thoughts I had in a paper that I'm about ready to deliver. So you can see from that comment that Jung was affected by Neumann. He was changed by Neumann through their correspondence and their work together and their conversations. They each challenged each other's thinking. And so I think that Neumann's influence on Jung was tremendous, absolutely tremendous. And I don't think we quite recognize how significant it has been.
So that really perhaps was the significance of this conference, was to kind of bring that into wider awareness.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there will be a revival of Neumann. I think there deserves to be a revival of Neumann. I think he has a tremendous amount to say, and I'm very excited about all these new publications that will be coming out, and I hope people find this as interesting as I do and go back and read the books that are published and pick up the new ones.
Yeah, and you mentioned that there is a title, the correspondence that we've been talking about. What's the title of that book?
The title is Analytical Psychology in Exile, The Correspondence of C.G. Jung and Erich Neumann.
Okay, well, as always, Nancy, you are a treasure trove of Jungian knowledge, and I really appreciate your sharing it with us.
Well, thank you, David. I'm more than happy to. I always enjoy our conversations, and thanks to Shrink Wrap Radio, it does a huge service to the community and the world.
Well, thank you. Nancy Ferlotti, thank you. Dr. Nancy Ferlotti.
Yes.
So my standard outro here. Dr. Nancy Ferlotti, I want to thank you for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, this was a very educational interview for me. I'm hoping it will have appealed to many of you other Jungian fans out there, and maybe even to some who are new to the Jungian worldview. By the way, the spelling of Neumann is N-E-U-M-A-N-N. In preparing for the interview, I found an excellent article on the web. It's a wonderful essay by Camille Paglia titled Erich Neumann, Theorist of the Great Mother. For those of you who may be unfamiliar with Camille Paglia, according to Wikipedia, she's an American academic and social critic. Paglia, a self-described dissident feminist, has been a professor at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, since 1984. The New York Times has described her as first and foremost an educator. She's a very bright, provocative personality, and you'll find a lot of interviews of her on YouTube. I recommend the interview with Bill Maher, that's B-I-L-L-M-A-H-R, 3 years ago on his show, Politically Incorrect. And Paglia is spelled P-A-G-L-I-A. Evidently, the G is silent. I would have pronounced it Paglia. But as I listened to others, it was pronounced silently. Unfortunately, I didn't have a copy of the Jung-Neumann correspondence book for this interview. However, Nancy Ferlotti has promised to send me one. The title, once again, is Analytical Psychology in Exile, The Correspondence of C.G. Jung and Erich Neumann, and is put out by the Philemon Foundation. And, as always, you're encouraged to order it using the Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site. And in so doing, we will get a small percentage of the price. In fact, you can order everything you order on Amazon.com, not just books, using our widget, and that's another way you can support the show.
Hey, Dr. Dave. My name is Carl, and I just wanted to call and take a minute to say thanks so much for the podcast. You do a great job, and I've probably been listening for about the last 5 years during my time in graduate school in Seattle and up to the present. Your shows have inspired me. They've been illuminating, entertaining, educational. So I really appreciate them. I'm a Jungian-leaning psychoanalytically trained therapist, and I've really enjoyed your guests over the years. Some that come to mind, Nancy McWilliams, David Wallen, Raul Moncayo, and recently Donald Kalshid, as well as many others. I've done my best to be an evangelist for the show, I've shared it a lot with my colleagues and friends, and I will continue to do so. I'm also happy to say that I've finally gotten around to becoming a financial contributor and plan on continuing to do that because the podcast has really helped me both as a therapist and just as a person. I think the show is great, especially, for us Jungians. But even before I was into the world of Jung, I enjoyed the show. I thought about writing you an email, but realized that you might enjoy it more hearing somebody's voice. And I think my reason for writing the email was just so that I could get something back. But then I thought, I've gotten plenty from you and hope you just enjoy hearing another human's voice who really appreciates the podcast and want to encourage you to keep up the good work. Thanks a lot, Dr. Dave. Take care.
Thank you, Carl. Well, as one of my many Jungian listeners, I think you will have received good value from today's guest. I really appreciate your support and your encouragement for other listeners who have the means to join you in becoming financial supporters of Shrink Wrap Radio. Fortunately, I can announce one new donor, and that's my recent guest from Shrink Wrap Radio number 461, Courtney Armstrong. Thank you for your donation, Courtney. I want to thank all of you who have purchased our new standalone app for Shrink Wrap Radio. As I mentioned before, I've heard reports from local friends who have bought it and they love it. They agree it's a much better solution than the podcast box option that we offered previously. We have a version for the iPhone and other iOS devices, plus for both Android and Windows smartphones. Just go to the Apps tab at Shrink Wrap Radio and get yours today. Once again, let me remind you that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, is offering a new course coming up soon that I think many of you will be interested in. It's a 10-class webinar titled The Frankenstein Prophecies, Jungian Archetypal Reflections on Ecological Crises, and the God Wars. And it's by Robert Romanishin, PhD. For full info and a 10% discount, just go to www.jungplatform.com and use Dr. Dave as the discount code at checkout. And Dr. Dave is just DRDAVE. Are you looking to refresh your life with a new career, either full-time or part-time? There are two great resources in the left-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com that can help you do that. The first is the International Coaching Academy that Dr. Sharon Livingston spoke about on Shrink Wrap Radio number 458. Just click on the icon in the left-hand sidebar that says Take the Coaching Test, which offers a free self-assessment, and then will take you to her site. My second recommendation is that you click on the Ed4 banner ad further down in the left-hand sidebar on our site. That will lead you to information on a whole raft of online courses that will train you for any one of a number of new careers. And by the way, they do offer financial aid. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, let me recommend an audiobook by Dr. James Hollis, one of my favorite Jungian authors and a past guest here on Shrink Wrap Radio. The title is Through the Dark Wood, Finding Meaning in the Second Half of Life, and that's by James Hollis, and as a bonus, it's also read by him. So if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that's not to your taste, they have more than 180,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is Dr. John Arden, psychologist, workshop leader, author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. John Arden, who it so happens I just had lunch with down in Marin County. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. I'll read just one, and it's from Katarzyna in Poland. And I hope I pronounced the name correctly. She writes, and I hope it's a she, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I'm not a professional psychologist or psychiatrist. I studied business science, management, international, political and economic relations, and marketing and PR communication. But I'm interested in psychology and psychiatry, especially in transpersonal psychology, for example, C.G. Jung, Stan Grof, also neuropsychology and neuropsychiatry. I like the eclectic nature of your podcasts, guests from different schools, although I'm of the opinion that rather tools, not schools, are more important when looking for psychological help. I even listened to interviews with Freud's experts and fans, although in my view, he did more harm than good to psychology and psychiatry. Some people even call him fraud, not Freud. In my opinion, Freud did one worthy thing, directed psychologists' attention onto unconscious processes, but a method of investigating them which he proposed, introspection, psychoanalysis, was a failure, so to speak, especially when taking into consideration how he saw people, mainly through the prism of their instincts as machines. A much better way of analyzing unconscious processes, which manage our thoughts and behavior, is proposed by Timothy Wilson in his book, Strangers to Ourselves. In short, self-observation and noticing how others react to our behaviors. As for correcting our conduct, he suggests following a piece of advice by Aristotle, do good, be good. Timothy Wilson could be a great guest on Shrinkwrap Radio, and she gives me a link to his website. She goes on to say, in my opinion, mainstream psychology focusing mainly on behavioral and mental processes is incomplete. It's like a science about an abnormal or underdeveloped state of man, deprived of the soul slash spirit. It determines certain standards of thinking and behaving and tries to correct so-called deviations or disorders, which according to Kazimierz Dąbrowski, are actually symptoms of psychical mental health if they lead to internal positive development and to creative acts. Ignoring the Jungian shadow, a darker side of ourselves, as some supporters of positive psychology suppose can be actually dangerous. Our physical and psychological state depends, of course, not only on what we have inside, so to speak, unconsciousness, but also on what we eat, on how we deal with stress and traumas, how we breathe, on genetics, brain injuries, toxins. So treatments by, for instance, Robert Hedaya, Stephen Porges, Peter Levine, and Paul Swingle can be very helpful. Below, I link to an extremely important book of Andrew Lobachevsky and to the webpage about him and his work. It's a must-read. I recommend it earnestly. It helps to understand why the big blue marble we live on is, in general, the veil of tears. I'm grateful for your podcasts! Best regard, Katarzyna. In order not to do her a disservice, I think I better spell that last name that she felt the author's work is so important. And his first name is Andrew, A-N-D-R-E-W. And his last name is spelled L-O-B-A-C-Z-E-W-S-K-I. Well, Katarzyna, thanks so much for your suggestions. I probably butchered some of those words in Polish. And of course, I can't give the URLs here because they tend to be too long. So people will just have to do their best to find them. And I will keep your suggestion in mind for a possible interview down the line, although I already have a very long list. And for somebody who's not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, I must say I'm impressed by your erudition and your knowledge of the field. I think Freud's contribution, you're right, I think that his discovery of the unconscious maybe is the single biggest one. But keep in mind that the unconscious is vast. That's actually a lot. and it's really informed all of depth psychology since his time. And so you made a number of good points, but I've got to move on. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Jungian analyst Dr. Nancy Furlotti, for revealing to us something about the importance of Erich Neumann and his relationship to C.G. Jung. On my next show, I'll be speaking with Drs. Elizabeth Johnston and Leah Olson, both of Sarah Lawrence College, and they have co-authored an important new book titled The Feeling Brain, The Biology and Psychology of Emotions. So won't you please join us? This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.